From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, filling in for Terry Gross. How does a batter figure out what the next pitch is going to be? Should he look for a slider, a knuckleball, or maybe the split-finger fastball? On today's Fresh Air, we'll find out from an expert, former Major League first baseman Keith Hernandez. His new book, Pure Baseball, is an inside guide to the tactics and strategies of the game. Also, it looks like Nancy Kerrigan outskated Tanya Harding in yesterday's Olympic competition. TV critic David Biancooley reflects on how CBS and the other networks covered the showdown. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Members of Congress are talking about whether the United States should hold up financial aid to Russia over the arrest of two alleged spies this week. Aldrich Ames and his wife Rosario were taken into custody on charges of spying for the former Soviet Union and then for Russia. Ames is a high-ranking CIA official. The Russian government has downplayed the story, saying the incident shouldn't spark a diplomatic flap. But UPI's Guy Chazan says many Russians are skeptical of the entire report.
There are a lot of grumblings by various security officials who are so far unnamed. For example, there was one interview in the paper Izvestia of an unnamed intelligence official saying that it was just all dreamed up by the CIA and the FBI to put pressure on Congress to increase their budget for this year.
Jurors in the World Trade Center bombing trial have begun their first full day of deliberation. Four men are being tried for the bombing last February 26th, which killed six people and injured more than 1,000. The judges told the jurors to use their common sense and that political beliefs are not on trial. Lawyers for both sides have urged jurors to carefully review the transcripts and exhibits. That could take time. The trial lasted 5 months and included more than 200 witnesses and a mountain of evidence. Veterans Affairs Secretary Jesse Brown says the epidemic of homeless American veterans is a tragedy that must not be allowed to stand. He estimates that some 250,000 veterans who fought for the United States now live on the streets. He's opened a two-day national conference on homeless vets in Washington, D.C. Brown told Congress yesterday about half the vets on the streets suffer alcohol and drug problems. He says increasing numbers have AIDS or HIV and tuberculosis. The Commerce Department says that factory orders for durable goods rose 3.7% last month. It's the first time since 1987 that orders have gone up 6 months in a row. Analyst Michael Evans says today's report is good news for the economy, but he says it may not result in more jobs.
The manufacturing sector has been pretty flat as far as employment goes for several years, and productivity is very high, but I don't think we're going to see any pickup there. Jobs will continue to increase in the service sector, but not in manufacturing.
The increase was nearly four times the size that analysts were expecting. It was led by growing demand for aircraft and for parts. Entertainer Dinah Shore has died. She was 76. Her publicist says that she was recently diagnosed with cancer and passed away at her Beverly Hills home. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down almost 52 points at 3,839. This is NPR. The Surgeon General has issued the 23rd report on smoking. Dr. Joycelyn Elders is issuing the report and says that she wants to focus on adolescent smoking and ways to combat it. The report says young people are facing great pressure to smoke. Elders adds that some of the pressure comes from the tobacco industry, which spends $4 billion yearly to promote its products. She wants to discourage teens smoking with higher cigarette taxes. She also wants strict enforcement of laws banning tobacco sales to minors. The National Academy of Sciences says researchers need to do more to include women in studies of new therapies and vaccines. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
Medical researchers have tended not to study women for a variety of reasons. For pregnant women or women who could become pregnant, there was always the fear that a new therapy could cause birth defects. But sometimes women were excluded from studies simply because it wasn't convenient to include them. The National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine panel says it's time for this to change. The panel recommends that all women, including pregnant women, be allowed to participate in studies of new drugs or vaccines as long as there is no reason to think the treatment will cause them harm and they are informed of potential risks. The Institute of Medicine report comes as the government is struggling to implement legislation passed last year mandating greater participation of women and minorities in government-sponsored research. This is Joe Palka in Washington.
The U.S. military says black soldiers at an army barracks in Germany are the targets of a hate campaign. A spokesman says investigators are working on the case that began more than a year ago. The Stars and Stripes newspaper says there have been incidents of telephone threats and slashed tires aimed at black officers. The report also says racial slurs have been found painted on the walls of the base. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. It's just 40 days till the season opens, spring training is well underway, and here in Philadelphia, news of John Kruk's diet is already hitting the papers. Former star first baseman Keith Hernandez has written a new book that can enhance your baseball viewing this year. In Pure Baseball, Pitch by Pitch for the Advanced Fan, Hernandez gives detailed narrations of two games from the 1993 baseball season. He was in Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia to see the Phillies beat the Atlanta Braves, and he watched the New York Yankees defeat the Detroit Tigers on TV. Hernandez dissects those games pitch by pitch and play by play. He explains the strategies of all the players and the managers and analyzes the key decisions made on and off the field. Keith Hernandez played with the St. Louis Cardinals, the New York Mets, and the Cleveland Indians during his 17-year career in the major leagues. He was named Most Valuable Player in 1979, and his defensive play at first base earned him the Gold Glove Award 11 years in a row. He was also known for having a near-perfect swing. Terry Gross spoke with Keith Hernandez earlier this week.
How do you develop a good eye as a batter? When you were up at bat and you were trying to follow a pitch, what would you look for?
Well, that's just years of training. I think I had a bat in my hand when I was 6 years old, a sawed-off Little League bat, and my dad threw it to me. So it's training. But I think basically if you're getting down to the nitty-gritty, you as a hitter have to concentrate on the point of release, where the pitcher lets go of the ball, whenever some pitchers throw overhand, some three-quarters, some sidearm. So you basically focus on wherever they release the ball. And you do see the motion, but it's all kind of around the periphery of your main focal point, your concentration point, a point of release. And then once the ball is released out of his hand, then your eyes have, in a split second, obviously, have got to really zoom in on the baseball and identify the pitch, which is why we have little red seams in the ball, because each pitch has a telltale giveaway with the rotation. If we didn't have the red seams in the ball and the ball was all white, the hitters, there would be no 300 hitters.
Right.
You get that?
So, were you usually accurate in what you assessed a pitch to be?
Well, I think I was accurate pretty much all the time. Every pitch has a giveaway in the rotation. Fastball comes in, and the ball's all white. If a pitcher throws a curveball, he is spinning the ball kind of like in an orb. The red seam makes like a moon orbiting the Earth or whatever. The ball is spinning in like a 1 o'clock. Let me get my times right. 1 o'clock to 7 o'clock mode. So it's like a tiny moon orbiting in a red line, and that tells you instantly it's a curveball. And make this as simple as possible. Slider. The seams make a little tiny red circle right in the middle of the ball, and everything else is white. So you know right away your mind says slider. Knuckleball has no spin. The split finger fastball, which made it so difficult, was that it did not have any telltale giveaway. It comes in like a fastball, then drops. So that's what makes that pitch so difficult. So there's an art to it, no question.
In your book, Pure Baseball, you talk a little bit about sometimes peeking at a catcher's signals to see what they were telling the pitcher to do. How would you do that, and how often would you do it?
That seems to be the one that everybody's most fascinated with so far. It's not really looking at the signals, because you couldn't. The key is I would do it only in certain situations late in the game if there's men on base. Mm-hmm. And some people might call this cheating. I don't. I'm looking for where the catcher is setting up. If I have a left-hand pitcher and I was a left-hand hitter, if the catcher is setting up outside, it's going to be either a fastball or a breaking ball away. If he's setting up inside, on the inside corner to me, he's not going to throw a curveball in there. It's for sure 100% going to be a fastball, and he's going to try to throw it inside. So what I would do when a pitcher would go in a stretch, because I'd only do it in situations late in the game where I could hurt him and maybe blow the game open or win the game or tie the game, et cetera, whatever. He'd go into a stretch. I would just, without moving my head, I would just kind of look out of the corner of my eye. And if I could see the catcher, he was set up outside. If I couldn't see him, he was set up inside. Now, you run the risk of a catcher setting up inside, and then as you peek back, he can shift back to the outside. That's the risk you take. But if you're observant, you watch your catcher, and you see what kind of pattern he has, what kind of habits he has back there. There were certain catchers I knew I couldn't peek on because they moved around, and they would set up inside and move outside or vice versa.
How legit is it to peek at a catcher?
How legit?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I think a couple pitchers got a couple losses on their record because I peeked late in the count. But it wasn't something, you can't do it all the time because the classic example, if they think you are, they're going to set up outside and make it obvious. You're going to think it's outside and they're going to hit you right in the head.
Right.
So there, and you have no gripe. You got it coming. So it was something I didn't do every day. Should I go to jail for this? Is this a felony? I feel like I'm on the witness stand. I only pick my spots on it. So there was very, very rare situations. And, of course, when I was red hot and really swinging the bat good or had a pitcher that I had good success off of or I had success that particular day, I wouldn't have to. But if a certain pitcher was in there that was tough and I wasn't swinging the bat that good, you know, for knowing location on the pitch, whether it's in or out, for one pitch of the at-bat, now I would try to take advantage of it.
Keith Hernandez is my guest. He has a new book called Pure Baseball. If you were on a streak, either a good streak or a bad streak, what would you do? How would you try to keep a good streak good, and how would you try to break out of a bad one?
To maintain a good streak, that's one of the things, that, I mean, what makes you go into a slump? And what makes you break out of a slump? Why do you go into a slump one day after you've been swinging the bat good for 3 weeks and you come to the park that day and boom, you've lost it? And then a 2-week slump and coming to the park and not having any clue, like you've never had a bat in your hand your whole career, and all of a sudden you come to the park one day, boom, and you break out. It's something you can't put your finger on. Now, the Lord will only give you so many base hits if he really cares about baseball. I think he's a baseball fan up there, that's for some reason. When you're red hot, you only have so many good swings. And I would take less batting practice. I didn't want to waste those swings. I would just go. I felt good at the plate. I would take a couple rounds to get loose. And normally, in a day-to-day, when you go take batting practice, you have around 5 rounds. The starting lineup, around 40 swings. I would take 15 just to get loose, get out of the box. Now, when you're in a slump, there's all kinds of things you can do to break out. I mean, you can take extra batting practice, come to the park early, which is a positive thing to do. But then you can overdo that. Sometimes you get in a slump and you have no clue and you just say, okay, I'm just not even going to hit today.
Were you a superstitious hitter?
I think every athlete is superstitious. I was superstitious, but not when it came to slumps. When you're in a slump, you're groping and trying to find the quickest way to get out. I mean, I wore my socks a certain way. I knew what sock went on my... That was my superstition. I knew what sock went on my right foot and which one on my left foot, and every year I would... The first hot streak I got into, whatever foot, the leg that sock was on, I'd keep it on the rest of the year. I had a ritual that I did in the on-deck circle that I did everything the same way. I was very precise and neat and had my the pine tar rag on one side, the towel to the other, and the rosin bag and all that stuff. I had a kept house there, so to speak. So I don't know. It's just one of the things, one of the idiosyncrasies of me when I played.
Would you talk to God about streaks?
No, I wouldn't take it that. He's got...
He's got bigger problems.
Bigger problems.
Right. Helping people win Academy Awards.
Right.
You broke your kneecap.
Yes.
When you were playing. How did you do it?
I got in a collision with Dave Anderson, who was playing second base for the Dodgers. This was 89, my last year with New York. It was also a year my contract was up, so I was having a good season, and we collided and knocked knees, and it was like a diamond cutter. He hit me just perfect, and it didn't shatter the kneecap. It just cut a clean break straight across horizontally.
How'd the collision happen?
He came in for a high hopper. I was on first base. I was running to second, and he was going to tag me on the baseline because it was a slow roller. He kind of like caught the ball and met me three-quarters of the way to second base, so I had to bump him. So he couldn't just tag me and complete the double play. And our knees knocked. And he was like 100. I was 210 pounds, and Dave Anderson was 175. And he walks away, and he breaks my kneecap. And that was an unfortunate injury for me.
Did you realize what had happened when...
No, I played two more innings. It hadn't swelled. And then I got in the third inning. I came in and was in the on-deck circle to hit. And I went to get up, and I couldn't get up. Then I realized it was something a little more serious.
How long did it take you to get back in the game after that?
I was out 8 weeks because the bone had to heal, obviously. And that was a six-week process. And then you've got to get back in shape. It was a leg injury. I couldn't run. And I never got back in shape. It was no matter what conditioning I did the 2 weeks to get back and to get back in after the bone heal. I was 36 at the time. I just didn't come around as quickly as possible, and I was really exhausted after every game for the rest of the season.
Did you feel you were never quite the same after that?
I didn't really realize how severe it was. I think it had more to do with my age, and I went to Cleveland the next year. I went to spring training, and I was, like, embarrassingly slow. I never was really a fast runner. When I went to Cleveland in spring training, I mean, I was 2 to 3 steps slower, and it was painfully apparent to me, and I just got to a point where I said, well, geez, am I going to be embarrassing myself now? An athlete doesn't want to hang on too long, and I had signed a 2-year deal with Cleveland. So as it turned out, that was pretty much the beginning of the end anyway, because injuries in my legs started coming after that, and I only played in the 2 years with Cleveland. I only played maybe 30 games due to leg and back injuries.
It must be hard to figure out what the moment is to actually retire.
Well, I knew it was in spring training. I just knew that I had that the culmination of other injuries, hamstring injuries that I'd had, and I tore a calf in Cleveland, and I just knew my body was saying it was time to go.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was on a 2-year, to be perfectly honest with you, when Cleveland's paying me $3.5 million for 2 years, who's going to turn his back on that kind of money and say, well, I retire? I'd be lying if I would say anything differently. I tried to do the best I could. And then in the off season after my first year with Cleveland, my back blew out, and I had surgery, and I missed the whole season, and I said, that's it, I retire.
So has your body come back?
No. I work out pretty much all the time, but I could never go out there and put that kind of rigors on my body that I did as far as playing when I played every day. I play a little bit of tennis, but if I play tennis, my back will act up after. I have to take a couple Advil to get the pain to go away. But basically, I just do a lot of cardiovascular, ride the bike. I've been able to run. I've seen a chiropractor once a week. That keeps my back in line, so I'm still able to run five miles around 4 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2 days in between, I'll ride a bicycle for an hour, a stationary bike. Otherwise, I'll get up to around 250 pounds in a heartbeat. I don't want to do that.
Right. Right.
Terry Gross speaking with former Major League Baseball player Keith Hernandez. We'll have more right after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Keith Hernandez is my guest. He has a new book called Pure Baseball, Pitch by Pitch for the Advanced Fan, and it's his like play-by-play analysis of two games in the 93 season. How did first base become your position?
I'm left-handed, number one. Doesn't leave you very many options. If you're left-handed in baseball, you can only play first base, pitch, or the outfield. And so my father was an ex-player, a minor league player, whose career was shortened when he got hit in the head back in the days when they didn't wear helmets, so his eyes kind of went bad. And my brother and I, growing up in California, when we were 6 years old, Dad had the sawed-off baseball bat and tennis balls and the gloves, and we played ball. And he was a first baseman, too. So he taught us from 6 years old.
Did he want you to be a first baseman?
Absolutely. No question. Stage father.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Your father had been in the minor leagues, and as you said, he was the stage father, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
How old were you when you knew that you were serious about baseball?
I was serious ever since I was six. The only time I had any diversions were I got distracted was, I think, this, which is pretty normal, is when you're 13 and you start, is it 13 when you start getting interested in girls? I don't know, or girls getting interested in boys or whatever. Then you kind of want to go surfing and you want to do this and that, and Dad just wouldn't let me do it. He let my brother do it, and he told me later that he knew I had the ability when I was 11 years old, believe it or not, which was Little League, to become a player.
So how would he prevent you from doing other things that would distract you from baseball?
Well, there's people in history like Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin. These dictators that just said, you're not surfing. You get in the car, we're going to go hit.
What was the punishment if you defied him?
I didn't. I was a good little boy. I was terrified.
Were you a good boy because you were terrified of him or because you thought that maybe he was onto something and if you wanted to play baseball professionally, you ought to be that disciplined?
No, I don't think I thought that.
It was fear.
He ruled the roost, and he was an authoritarian-type individual, and what he said went. That's just the way it was. My brother was more... would stand up against him. I remember when he first stood and shouted back at him, it was like I was an observer. I mean, I was like sitting there going, oh my God, I don't believe this was happening. And I give Gary credit. We still laugh about it to this day.
So when you were starting to play in little leagues or in school teams, would your father show up for the games and act like he was your coach?
No, he would... No. I mean, Dad was great. He was our coach all throughout Little League.
Oh, he was your coach?
Yes.
He didn't have to act like he was your coach.
But that was all very fine and dandy. Dad got a little bit carried away and obsessive with it when I became a teenager, when he started losing control, when now the high school coach had control of me. And he kind of was obviously a control person. But he was a fireman for 30 years, and he worked 24 hours and was off 48. And those 48 hours he was off, the 2 days, if we worked out baseball in high school, he was up there in the blue Mustang watching like Big Brother. It made me very nervous. But nothing much I can do about it. I mean, he made sure I wasn't getting any bad habits. I mean, the one sport that I enjoyed the most, and I'm not being critical of my father. My dad was a very, very loving father, but he did become obsessed, and I think did live his life through my career, and it became difficult later in life. Our relationship was very off and on, which is unfortunate, but that's the way it goes. He was doing the best that he could. But getting back to the point, basketball I enjoyed the most, and I think I had my best improvement in high school, is because he couldn't come in the gym and watch me work out. Mm-hmm. I only had to worry about him when I was playing the game, which was twice a week. So that's all part of father-son's relations, and, you know, you never do everything 100% correct.
Well, you know, I think it's difficult for most teenagers to figure out how to declare their independence to their parents. And it must have been particularly hard for you since your father, as you say, was living vicariously through your playing.
Well, It was tough, and it was remained tough. I mean, I know, and it's such a good point. I mean, there should be a book written about this. When I see parents on TV that overdo it with their children in a Little League game, mm-hmm. where kids should be having fun, and I just kind of cringe. Or a parent in a high school game that's on his kid, I cringe, because you just don't want to take the fun out of the game. You want your kids to enjoy it. Sports are sports. It's a recreation. It's meant to be good, healthy competition, and not undue pressure put on the child and making them nervous, etc. I mean, I got to be. I haven't done interviews in so long. I mean, it's an issue that touches me right to the bone, because even when I was an adult, Dad would still try to say, well, I know what you're doing wrong, if I was in a slump, because Mom was very ill for a great part of her life, and so she couldn't leave the house. So I bought them a dish, and I knew when I bought them a dish, I knew what I was getting in for. But Mom was just sitting there, and they can watch my games with the Mets off the satellite. But the other side of the coin was that Dad could watch me every day, and there was always a constant battle. Well, I can get you out of the slump, and I go, well, relax, don't worry about it. I've been in them before. And then he'd go, well, you're not going to get out if you don't listen to me, all that sort of junk. And now, I mean, that I have, when I retired, I've been in therapy now for like 3 years. And I've kind of more of an understanding about it now, where Dad was coming from, how, and I allowed it. I mean, I could have stopped it from the get-go, but it's a difficult thing to do.
Well, you must have felt for him, too, really wanting this baseball career and never quite getting it.
You know something? It was tough enough for me to play, and Dad was in his 50s. I mean, you know, let go. It's just like... my brother told him, he said, if I would have told you when Keith was 18 and signed his professional contract, his first contract out of high school, that Keith would have been on two World Series, will be in two World Series champions, will be a most valuable player, a batting champion, and win 11 Golden Gloves, and go to 6 All-Star games, and be almost a 300 lifetime hitter, would you be happy? And he said, yes. And he goes, well, then why aren't you happy?
Really?
You know, like it was never good enough, you know? So he was, that's why I think I always was driven to be the best that I could be, because I think my dad always drove me. And I don't want to make it sound too harsh. I mean, it wasn't like he cracked a whip or anything like that, but he always demanded that you give it 100%. And we were trained that way when we were kids. And I think there's a lot of good out of that. But there's a fine line that you have to draw where you do damage. And you're helpful, or you're going to do damage to your child growing up. And I think parents should really be on their guard with that, and particularly if they have a son that has a future. And parents, I think, when they see the goal, when the kids are in high school and it's that close, where A, they're going to go to college, or B, they're going to get signed a professional contract, they can't get carried away. They got to keep in focus the fact that they're dealing with a human, an individual here. And you don't want to do anything that's going to emotionally damage your child.
That's former first baseman Keith Hernandez speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more from their interview in the second half of the show. I'm Chris Spurgeon, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Chris Spurgeon with Fresh Air. Coming up, life after the major leagues. We continue our conversation with Keith Hernandez, former first baseman for the New York Mets. We talk about why he quit the game and what he's been doing since he retired from baseball, including his guest shot on a celebrated episode of Seinfeld. And the much-ballyhooed Nancy Kerrigan-Tanya Harding showdown is underway. How have the media added to the fray? TV critic David Bean Cooley has a review of the network's coverage. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Communications Commission is rejecting suggestions that the agency killed one of the largest telecommunications mergers in U.S. history. Bell Atlantic and Telecommunications Incorporated, or TCI, have called off their planned merger. The deal collapsed one day after the FCC ordered cable TV firms to cut their rates. Officials handling the merger say that TCI, a cable firm, lost market value after the FCC decision. FCC Commissioner James Coelho says, however, the real reason the $21 billion deal fell through is because TCI was overpriced. The United States and North Korea are talking for the third time this week about nuclear inspections in the Korean country. Some progress has been reported. Linda Fasulo has more on the story.
Facing possible international sanctions, North Korea agreed last week to allow some nuclear inspections, but did not issue required visas to UN experts. At yesterday's meeting, Pyongyang reportedly made an offer that would allow inspectors to enter the country on March 1st if certain demands were met. They include Washington setting a date for high-level talks on improving ties and canceling its annual military exercises with South Korea. However, the U.S. wants Pyongyang to name an envoy for talks with South Korea on making the peninsula a nuclear-free zone. Further talks on inspections of two additional sites suspected of nuclear weapons activity are expected next month. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo reporting.
One of the nation's top liberal arts colleges will soon offer an accelerated degree. Leaders of prestigious four-year private colleges have discussed the idea for years, but starting in 1995, Middlebury College in Vermont will be among the first to offer a three-year degree. From member station WBUR in Boston, Doug McPherson reports.
For nearly 200 years, Middlebury has prided itself on being an uncompromising proponent of the liberal arts and has built an international reputation for its summer language schools. College President John McArdle says nothing has changed and that the new program will be open to highly motivated and highly qualified students who will study for three academic years and two summers.
There is nothing particularly magical about 4 years, nor is there anything magical about three. In fact, we're seeing more of our students either interrupting their programs of study or accelerating their programs of study.
McArdle says the new program recognizes the increasing burden of financing a college education. The new program is projected to save students at least $18,000 over 4 years. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug McPherson in Boston.
On Wall Street, stock prices were hit by panic selling today as investors reacted to a sharp increase in interest rates. The Dow lost 51 points. This is NPR. A study on health care finds that Americans are strongly committed to universal health care coverage, meaning that all Americans would have access to health care. The Public Agenda Foundation says citizens are willing to make sacrifices, including paying higher taxes, the more they learn about problems with the current health care system. But the survey finds that many Americans are skeptical about government solutions. An analyst with the RAND Corporation raised questions today about the administration's policy toward Iran during a forum sponsored by the Middle East Policy Council. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly has more.
The U.S. has been pursuing a policy dubbed dual containment where Iran and Iraq are concerned, believing that it's in the U.S.'s best interest to maintain a balance in power between the two and not be seen as favoring one over the other. But RAND Corporation analyst Graham Fuller believes the two countries should not be treated alike and that the threat from Iran has been greatly exaggerated.
The Iranian regime is capable of change. We should seek to open dialogues and not close them with nations with whom it will be possible to have a discussion. I don't even know whether the U.S. is going to be capable of opening a dialogue with Iran, but I think Iran is capable of opening dialogues, at least regionally, and is doing so.
Fuller agrees with the administration on at least one point, that Iran, with its support of Hezbollah and Hamas, does pose a threat to the Middle East peace process. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Jurors in the Branch Davidian murder trial are weighing the charges that have been lodged against 11 sect members. This is the second day of deliberations. The Davidians are charged with conspiring to kill four federal agents last year who were trying to arrest sect leader David Koresh. Federal District Court Judge Walter Smith has told them they can find the defendants acted in self-defense if they believed they were in imminent danger. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're going to continue with Terry Gross's interview with former Major League Baseball star Keith Hernandez. In his 17-year career in the majors, Hernandez played on two world championship teams, the St. Louis Cardinals and the New York Mets. He retired from the game 3 years ago and has now written a book called Pure Baseball, Pitch by Pitch for the Advanced Fan. Terry Gross spoke with Keith Hernandez earlier this week.
When you started to play professionally, did you feel that your emotional maturity and your maturity as a player happened at about the same time?
No, definitely not. I think that, if anything, emotionally, you are, we're living a college life. I mean, we're traveling around the country, 10-day road trips, 10-day homestands with 25 guys. And I think it keeps you in that college mode, I think, where you don't grow up. And I've been retired now. This is going on my third year. And my life's changed completely. I've come to understand that, I mean, I've led a pretty exciting life, baseball on the road, a challenge every night, playing in front of 50,000 people. That's a lot of fun. And now all of a sudden, it's like, oh, well, it's like there's a void in my life, and I've got to find out what I want to do. And financially, I'm not rushed, where I have to get a job and do something I won't like. And that's one positive thing out of it. But it's been an adjustment. I mean, I don't miss the game. I'm sick of competing, sick of having to go out there. I did it for 20 years, kind of minor league, 17 in the big leagues. And I've had enough, but I've got to fill this void in my life now. I got the whole second half of my life ahead of me.
You said that you had become sick of competing. What started to get to you about competing?
Well, baseball, as you know, is 162 games in 182 days. So that's a 6-month season with 20 off days. And you get 3 in a row off for the All-Star break. And you get more off days in April when it's cool and you don't need them and the season's just starting because of rainouts, potential rainouts, and ownership does not like to have to give fans their ticket back for a doubleheader, 2 for the price of 1, which I can't blame them, the economics of the game. Just going out there every day, and sometimes you go out there and you're sick and you got to play and you're in a slump and you're leaving men on base. I just got tired of it, having to play at that level. And it took a long time. I mean, I think maybe what made it easier for me to retire was the fact that I got hurt the last two years of my career. Up to that point, I hadn't been hurt at all. I'd never been on the disabled list for 13 and a half years. I was just played basically injury-free. But when I performed at this one level for so long and then wasn't able to perform because of physically I wasn't able to perform, it was easier for me to pull away.
You know, when you're as involved and obsessive with something as you were about baseball, there's not as much room for life outside of that as other people have for their private lives. Have you tried to compensate with that now that you're not in the game anymore?
Well, I tell you, I signed when I was 18 out of high school, and I never had a summer off until I retired. Mm-hmm. I was 38, 20 years. So I'm here in New York, and I got friends with homes out in the Hamptons and fishing boats and, hey, let's go down to Florida and fish down there. And having the weekend off where everybody's not working and being able to be around those people. I mean, weekends are always the big draw days. We're part of the summer fun, baseball.
Right.
But to be able just to get in the car and take a drive on a weekend if I want to, It's perfect, you know, and you can't help but just invariably, when you're running through the radio, and it'll be the ball game on, or some ball game somewhere, whatever town I'm in, and go, well, that is not part of my life anymore. I'm in my car, and whoever I'm with, I'm happy being with, and it's a beautiful summer day, and here I am on a either driving or I'm on a boat fishing. How great can that be?
Yeah. When you were traded to the Mets, they were in last place,
mm-hmm.
and they ended up in first place. you won the series with the Mets. What was it like to land on a last place team at the beginning, you know, when you didn't know that they'd turn around?
Well, they traded me in the middle of the season, June 15th, I remember, and I had to go join the club in Montreal from St. Louis. When I first was traded there, I mean, I was on bad terms. Whitey Herzog, who was the manager of the Cardinals at the time, and I were not getting along. And for quite some time. And, I mean, it wasn't adversarial, but it was just vibrations. I knew he didn't like me. And to be honest with you, he traded me there in the hopes of burying me there into a last-place team. It was no mistake I was traded to a team that perennially was losing 100 games a season. What they didn't realize was that they had a wealth of minor league talent that obviously was right there ready to come up, and it was just an ideal situation for a veteran like me. And it was perfect. The Dykstras, the Goodens, and the list goes on. It must have been 12 young players that came up all at once from the minor league system. That with me as a 30-year-old veteran, it was just an ideal situation. It was just the most fun of my career.
Mm-hmm.
So what goes around comes around, I guess.
Former Major League Baseball player Keith Hernandez talking with Terry Gross. We'll have more right after this break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is Keith Hernandez, and he has a new book called Pure Baseball. I want to ask you about the investigation into drug use. In 1985, you testified to a grand jury in return for immunity about your use of cocaine in baseball. And I think you said you'd used it for like 3 years, from 80 to 83. Do you think that it damaged temporarily your relationship with your fans?
I think it was the first shocking scandal drug-wise that shocked America, society. I mean, I think they put athletes on a pedestal, particularly in that period. I mean, the first one, obviously, was Ball 4 with Jim Bouton.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there was people are naive to think that athletes aren't, or entertainers, aren't susceptible to the same temptations and weaknesses of a guy that works 9 to 5, no matter what he does. This was really a shocker for the public. I mean, it's something I'm not proud of, but it was an eye-opener for society. And I think if it happened today, it would have been far less of the sensationalism. The story wouldn't have been such a big story. I think people are more aware now that athletes aren't perfect and they have the same frailties and weaknesses as anybody else. But when it happened then, it was like, you know, it was like Zeus or Apollo had fallen from Mount Olympus.
You used to smoke cigarettes while you played. You smoked in the dugout.
Oh, yeah.
So,
Now, the only reason why I smoked in the dugout was because Shea Stadium had no tunnel in the back where you can hide. that led to every dugout has a tunnel that runs back into the clubhouse, and you can watch the game from there and smoke a cigarette if you want. In Shea Stadium, you went down to the left, down the stairs, and up the stairs, and if you wanted to smoke a cigarette in the tunnel, you couldn't watch the game. Your view was totally blocked. If they had had a proper tunnel, no one would ever have seen me smoke in the dugout.
But you'd still be smoking.
Oh, I smoked a pack a game.
How did you manage to do that? I mean, I know from my days as a smoker that you really get winded from it.
Yeah, but we're running all the time. And if I had to score in a double from first base, and so first to home, and I felt it. If I hit a triple, I felt it. But, you know, you're always running and you're blowing it out. My wind was always good.
Huh.
And I would always not smoke so much in the off season. I would not have cigarettes around the 5 months off. But starting spring training, boy, it was just nervous habit and tension, and that was a way. I mean, every half inning I'd light up a cigarette.
Did a lot of your fellow players smoke?
Yes, on all the teams I played for. But I think a lot of that's changing. I think athletes are more aware. I should say, even society. Look at society.
You're not allowed to smoke anywhere. It's
so
really hard if you're a smoker.
I just really think that baseball is a microcosm of society. And
yeah.
The 25 guys in the team are symbolic of society. And our team, whatever the percentage of smokers there was back then, there was around 12 smokers in the team. We had a lot of smokers.
So how'd you give it up?
I really smoke still today a little bit. I don't have them at home.
You take them from friends, right?
I'm the worst.
When I was giving it up, I always had my friends who I'd wait expectantly for, hoping they'd have a cigarette.
Well, if I'm out, I have a hard time. And I do, if my doorman in New York, if I need a cigarette, they'll come up and I'll buy I buy them a carton a month to keep them happy. But I've cut my smoking down. Sometimes I'll have not one during a day. No more than five, which is really quite good. And there might be several days go by I don't have a cigarette.
Yeah.
But when I tend to get outside and you smell the smoke, it's tough for me not to light up.
Right. Keith Hernandez is my guest. He has a new book called Pure Baseball. That's his play-by-play analysis of two games from the 1993 season. A couple of years ago, there was a great Seinfeld episode, an hour-long special episode that you starred in. That was really a lot of fun. You played yourself, and you and Jerry Seinfeld became friends, and he was just so in awe of you that it was always for him as if he was going out on a first date with somebody, and he wasn't sure whether he could, he was worthy of this relationship or not.
Right.
How did you get the role on that? Did they write that part for you?
Actually, they called my baseball agent, and they came with the idea. We want to do a show with Keith playing himself. I mean, all the writers on the show and Jerry himself, they're all New Yorkers, and we're all Brooklyn Dodger, New York Met fans. So evidently, I was Jerry's favorite player, and it was his idea, so they came up with the idea. And ironically, it was supposed to be a half-hour show, and they overrode it for like 7 minutes. So either they had to take 7 minutes out or add another 12, which would mean more scenes. And I think when I showed up on the Monday, which we rehearsed all for an entire week, I think they wanted to get a feel for me to see if I was going to be real bad, then they wouldn't make it an hour. Or if they felt that I was okay, they would make it an hour. So as it turned out, they obviously made it into an hour show, and they used it on Sweeps Week, which was incredible, and it was their highest rated show. So I don't know if I had anything to do with that, but I know I got tired of hearing my name. They mentioned my name 24 times on that show.
How did you like playing yourself? Did you do something different to be yourself?
No, I had a lot of lines, and I was more worried about getting my lines right. And then we had to do it in front of a live audience, which was petrifying. And then the next day we did it over in studio. I just played myself. I mean, it's funny how when you read a script and I wouldn't say it that way, but I'm not Marlon Brando and I can't go to the director and say I want to change these lines.
So you read it in their language instead of your own?
Well, he more or less said, if you have a way you would say it that you feel more comfortable, go ahead. They gave me pretty much leeway. But, you had to stay within this time frame on an hour show. You can't just go off into this dissertation on something. But it was all very fun, and I had a great time. They were all wonderful. And it was really, people remember me now more for Seinfeld than playing. I mean, people come out the street and say, well, hey, can I help you move? Which was one of the... that's all I hear all the time, so, which is great.
So do you want to act some more and play other people?
Well, actually, I just did a Law and Order series. Which I'm acting is something I'm not pursuing. I mean, I'm not going to act in class, but I will do it. I mean, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I just did a Law and Order.
Are you playing yourself in that?
No, I play another it's a completely different makeup individual. I am a ball player, an aging star, so I guess I'm sort of playing myself. I have one scene where I'm a teammate of mine is in trouble with the law, and I'm being, over coffee, I'm being interrogated by the assistant DA.
Oh, I'll try to watch that. When are you eligible for the Hall of Fame?
I believe it's 5 years after you retire, you're eligible, if I'm correct.
So are you hoping to get in?
Well, I would, of course, I'd love to get in. I think I'm kind of on the bubble there, a little bit on the borderline. Well, we'll see. I know I won't get on the first ballot. The first ballot is for those that really just had statistics that were so incredible. I just don't know. People tell me I will. I don't think I will.
Would it mean a lot to you?
Of course.
Of course, right.
Yes.
A foolish question.
If you went into the Radio Hall of Fame, would it mean a lot to you?
If there was one, it sure would. Yeah. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Good.
Keith Hernandez. His new book is called Pure Baseball, Pitch by Pitch for the Advanced Fan.
It shouldn't take too long. I'd say maybe, 4 hours. Really, though, Jared, there's not that much. First, we got the bedroom. We got two dressers in the bed.
Is there a box spring?
What's that?
Is there a box spring?
Yeah, there's a box spring, but it's attached to the headboard, and we'll have to take that apart. But the big problem is going to be the convertible sofa. See, when you move it, it tends to open up, so it's going to be real difficult getting it down the stairs.
Stairs? There's no elevator?
No, it's a brownstone, 3 floors.
I'm sorry, I can't do this.
What?
I can't do it, I can't. It's too soon, I don't know you. I can't help you move, I'm sorry, I can't, I just can't.
Keith Hernandez on Seinfeld. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah, what's in store?
Hi, Chris. John McChesney has a report on the collapse of a mega communications merger between Bell Atlantic and TCI. The Surgeon General, Joycelyn Elders, has a new report that connects teenage smoking with other high-risk activity. We'll have letters from listeners tonight about Christopher Buckley's comments on Tanya Harding and gay and lesbian couples and Valentine's Day. Also, a discussion of the game of bandy, which is played in the Scandinavian countries and in Minnesota. It's sort of like field hockey on ice, with the potential for violence missing. It's played with a ball and curved sticks, and bandy fans are trying to make it an Olympic sport.
Okay, thanks, Noah. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A lot of people, an awful lot of people, watched CBS's primetime coverage of the Olympics last night when the network showed Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan finally taking to the ice and performing. TV critic David Bean Cooley saw it too, but he also watched much earlier and much later to see how that famous duel was covered. David starts with Harry Smith on today's CBS This Morning.
For those few people who may not have seen Nancy Kerrigan's performance last night, we will replay it in its entirety a little bit later.
But don't worry, I won't. We won't know until tomorrow, when the national Nielsen ratings come out, exactly how many skillions of people watched CBS last night. But I can't imagine that many people missed it. And I can imagine that tomorrow's skating finals, with Kerrigan in position for a medal and Harding in position for disappointment, are going to land one of the biggest TV audiences in years. Meanwhile, I was fascinated by how this story was covered in its final days, by CBS and by everybody else. Because of the time difference between here and Norway, CBS has hours and hours to juggle and assemble the taped elements of its coverage. Both Harding and Kerrigan competed in Norway about 7 hours before they were shown on CBS in primetime. During its 3-hour coverage, CBS decided to show the performances of 10 female figure skaters out of a field of 27. Kerrigan had skated 26th, so there must have been a lot of drama as people in the arena watched one last competitor take to the ice and try to take Kerrigan's lead away. But I'm only guessing about that, because CBS skipped number 27 entirely, and in one of its typical time-shuffling maneuvers, made it look and sound as though Kerrigan had skated, gotten her scores, and locked up first place for the day. Vern Lundquist makes the call.
Second set of marks. Nancy Kerrigan is atop the leaderboard with 7 of 9 ordinals. She has won the technical program.
I don't blame CBS for holding Kerrigan until the last half hour of primetime, and I was both surprised and glad that they showed Harding so early. After she skated, for almost 2 hours of Olympics coverage, her name was never mentioned, which was a real relief. But early yesterday afternoon, when Harding was skating live, the TV networks had to put her and the story in a larger context. Even though CBS had exclusive first rights to the video, the other networks had access to the results and had the option to relay the scores and standings. CBS, protecting its video exclusive, didn't do a news break. Neither did ABC. But NBC did, with Tom Brokaw coming on to announce that Harding had committed a costly error. On cable, TNT was the network with official daytime Olympics coverage. It revealed Harding's scores as they were released, and so did ESPN and CNN. On CNN, it just so happened that a couple of comedians, being interviewed on the talk show Sonya, were able to watch the live in-house TNT feed as Tonya Harding skated. We couldn't see the judges' scores, but the comics could, and Kevin Meaney took the opportunity to poke fun at Harding's devilish image. He said with a straight face, "She got a 666." One final note. On the evening network newscasts yesterday, CBS and NBC led with the skating story, but ABC didn't. World News Tonight went with the spy scandal instead, filing 2 long stories on it that took the newscast up to the first commercial break. When he returned, Peter Jennings finally turned his attention to the Olympics and to women's skating. But even then, he was delivering a very deliberate message about context and news values. He started not with Tonya and Nancy, but with Bonnie Blair, who had just won her 5th gold medal. Kerrigan skated herself into medal contention yesterday, and Harding probably stumbled herself out of it. But with its evening newscast, it was ABC that glided away with the gold.
David Bean Cooley is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Vobitis, and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Chirac directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Chris Spurgeon. Name of the Father is up for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. On the next Fresh Air, Terry Gross talks with Jim Sheridan, the film's director, and with Jerry Conlon, whose story is told in the film. Conlon spent 15 years in prison after being wrongly accused of being an IRA terrorist. Join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.